Edwin K. Morris, and you are about to embark on the next Pioneer Knowledge Services Because You Need to Know, a digital resource for you to listen to folks share their experience and knowledge around the field of knowledge management and nonprofit work. If your company or organization would like to help us continue this mission and sponsor one of our shows, email BYNTK at pioneer-ks.org.
Hi, my name's Nick Milton. I'm a knowledge management consultant and author. I live in the UK. I live in a little village between Bath and Bristol, for those of you who know the UK. Little tiny place, there's only 20 houses in the village. And I have my own knowledge management company. We've been going since 1999 now, with representatives around the world. We do KM strategy, we do KM service work, we do assessments. And I'm the director of the company. I've written several books on the topic. I've written six now, either on my own or with co-authors. You may know the Knowledge Management Handbook. Patrick Lamb and I published a couple of years ago. That seems to be pretty well received, actually. That was us writing the book that we wished we'd had when we started in the knowledge management field 30 years ago. We're actually starting a follow-up to that one, the Knowledge Manager's Field Book. We've written about half a dozen chapters of that so far, which is going to be looking more at how knowledge management is expressed in different contexts and in different settings. Because we all know that with knowledge management, there is no one-size-fits-all. So the topic I can talk about for hours, actually, you know, the subtopic within KM is probably either lesson learning or communities of practice. Yeah, and then probably I can talk equally long about governance aspects. It's a big, big topic. It's an area that I've worked in now for 30 years. My first mentor was the guy who led the KM program at BP. His name's Kent Greenis. He was brilliant, Kent. He was very insightful. He was a fantastic leader. I took much of my inspiration from him. In the workspace, I love to get into a company that's really just kicking off with KM and see where they're going and what they need and how to tailor a solution that will fit their needs. And I am inspired when they pick it up and run with it. I mean, sometimes as a consultant, you go in, you speak to people, you give them lots of good stuff, you go away and you think, will I ever hear from them again? But when you do, and when they're really making a difference, that is inspirational. So I stay connected to people like everybody does online nowadays. I blog on a weekly basis. I've got my website. I'm on Twitter. That's my way of staying connected. And if I was stranded on an island, and my top three must-haves, am I allowed to choose a boat? I mean, that's the obvious one. I was going to say a boat, an outboard motor, and a jerry can of fuel, please. Mind you, I quite like islands. The alternative would be a swimming pool, my wife, and a cold beer. What else can I share?
Oh, that's awesome. Nick Milton, what is the most significant thing in your history that led you to KM?
Well, I think like many of the early KM practitioners, I fell into it by accident. I'd already been working 18 years in industry as a geologist, looking at rocks, trying to find oil fields. I was lucky enough to be seconded. I was working for British Petroleum at the time, and I was lucky enough to be seconded to the Norway office for 5 years. The role they gave me, they called it quality advisor, sort of accountable for the quality of the work that was being done out there. And the quality of geological work is all about knowledge. It's all about knowing your rocks, knowing what they're trying to tell you, what messages they give you. And they always say that the best geologist is the one that's seen the most rocks. But you know, you can't see them all. It's very true. One of the things we looked at was the whole concept of learning as an organization, particularly sharing learning between the teams and collecting lessons and sharing those lessons. So I used to spend probably about a third of my time doing straight geology, about a third of my time mentoring people, and the remaining third was on knowledge management. We didn't call it knowledge management in those days because this was, we're talking about 1992. I think the term was just beginning to emerge. When I came back from Norway in 97, KM was becoming a rather more hot topic, and British Petroleum had started their own internal knowledge management team. And they looked at the work that I'd been doing in Norway, on the particularly on the lesson learning, organizational learning side, and said, would you like to come and join the team? So I jumped at it. I thought that was, as much as I love geology, that this KM thing goes far broader, far wider.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So how did you know that that was, that had that capability? I mean, what was the one thing that made it so shiny you just couldn't look away?
Well, a couple of things. One of them, going back to the mid-90s, you know, this, we were only just getting desktop computers. We were only just getting email. And one of the things that BP did at the time, that the chief executive, Lord Brown, was very far-sighted. He was great. He said the whole of BP must go on a common operating platform. And people kicked and screamed about this. There was the Mac supporters, there were the PC supporters. But he said, no, we've got to be on a common system so we can talk to each other. And they set up, among other things, a discussion forum for geologists around the world.
Ah.
We had something going on in Norway that completely puzzled us. We were seeing these strange things on the seismic data. So I took a screenshot of this and I put it up on the geologists forum. And I said, has anybody else seen this? And we got answers from around the world. The chief geologist came on and said, look, this is just fantastic. This is how we... This is how we will use new technology. This is us tapping into the brains of the organization. And that was a penny dropping for me. You know, you don't need to be isolated in your own country office. There's a great world out there who can help you. That was one. And then the second was when we went through a license round. Now, a license round, I don't know what they call them in the US, maybe a lease sale or something. It's where you buy the rights to explore for oil on packages of land, except in Norway they're all packages of sea, or seabed. We did a good job. We did a really good job, and then afterwards we collected our lessons learned. We wrote up our lessons learned. We actually, from those lessons, we built, I wouldn't necessarily call it best practice, but an effective practice in working a license round. About 2 months after we finished that, we got a call from Australia saying, we're starting a license round. Can we see your best practice? And we sent that down to them, actually, with one of the guys who'd been working on license round. He went down with all of this best practice and passed it on to them. And that was the second penny dropping, this idea of packaging your experience, packaging what you know, and then passing it on as a starter for the next people.
Did you see that there was an advantage of having a person come with the data? It's one of those things that I think a lot of organizations don't recognize, is that having a social Sherpa, you know, my term, somebody that can help bridge that lack of knowledge to knowledge, was that helpful? I mean, was that something that iconic, that you're like, you know, we should always have somebody go with a package, so to speak?
Yeah, definitely. And even if they don't go with the package, you know, their contact details are there in the package. You can never write down everything you know. If you write down details for somebody, they'll come back to you with questions, and that's great.
Exactly.
But at the same time, if you don't write it down, you forget it. The human brain is a lousy knowledge store. It really is. So I think...
Well, wait a minute. I thought they were building all the artificial intelligence to mimic us. What are they mimicking?
They're mimicking what we write.
Okay.
We can, and you never write it all down. So it takes the people and it takes the documents, and the two have to live side by side. They have to go hand in hand. Tacit, explicit. It's the two chambers of the heart of KM.
Oh, say that again.
Tacit and explicit is the two chambers of the beating heart.
Bring up that point of having the social bridge maker to go with the content because it just facilitates learning so much faster. Mm. The absorption of just raw information, raw data, takes a certain amount of time. First, you have to get associated with it, then you have to comprehend it, and then you have to chew it up and understand it. And if you've got a social connector, a bridge maker to go along with that, that can help facilitate that quicker, it's almost like the paradigm of learning that has shifted in the last 50 years of going from the professor-centric or teacher-centric to the learner-centric model, to where content is developed to best suit the consumer of learning, the consumer of content. There's an ability here, I think a lot of organizations just don't inspire to, I'll say, because there seems to be a technological shelf that they sit on, and then the social part, just they just wait for it to happen. Do you see that at all? I mean, how do you fix that?
Yes, I see that. Larry Prusak used to say, you know, if you believe that you can transfer knowledge through documents, presumably you don't send your child to school. You just give them books to read.
Yeah.
So I think that's just Larry sort of calling people's bluff. I think you're right. There is a huge interest in, at the moment, in written knowledge. The written word is a source of knowledge, but it never is. It's never the sole source of knowledge, and you've got to have the tacit with it. How do you explain that to people? I think you demonstrate it. Mm. One of the ways that I demonstrate it, we've got a really good practical exercise where we divide people into teams. We give them a challenge. They try the challenge. They do pretty poorly. Then they do an after action review. Then they do a peer assist. And then you show them best practice.
Yeah.
Not only
yeah.
show them, but talk them through it. And when we do the debrief afterwards, I always ask, what was the benefit of having me talk you through that best practice?
Uh-huh.
And they always say, oh, it wouldn't have worked without you. Because you give emphasis. You explain why you do things the way you do. You say, this is the one thing you mustn't fiddle with. You can fiddle with the rest. I think it's very, very hard to divorce the human from the knowledge.
From my experience, what you just talked about, there is an ability to bring a sympathetic or empathetic, emotional-based connection, just a contextual connection to the content that the human can represent, and sometimes represent really well, and sometimes represent very poorly, as we all know. Not everybody's built for public speaking or teaching or that sort of thing. The conveyance is really an oratory skill in order to help facilitate the learning. But how do you build that practice? How does an organization build that practice?
I don't know that it is necessarily an oratory skill. I think the more important component is to have people talking with their peers. And I'll give you an example of that. We were working after I left BP, after I set up my own company, one of our clients was De Beers, the diamond miners. And we had a peer assist in a diamond mine in Kimberley, I think it was. No, it's Botswana. That's where Botswana. And we brought in a whole lot of people from the other diamond mines to share their practice. And there would, the managers would stand up and speak, and everybody would sort of sit back like this with their arms crossed. Then the mining engineers would get up and speak. And everyone was leaning forwards. They were listening. They were, because this was somebody just like them. This was another mining engineer who spoke their language, knew their context. They weren't the best speakers, but there was a bond there.
Okay, so there's got to be a social trust mechanism that helps bridge that content. So you're saying that's more of an attribute of good transfer than it is just being able to speak well.
Yes, I think that's right. And it's not even necessarily a social trust. There's a sort of professional trust.
Hmm.
The big communities of practice, so if you go to somewhere like Shell, where they've had tremendous success with their huge communities of practice, there may be 1,000 members in a community.
Hmm.
They don't know each other. They don't have any social bond with each other, but they have a professional trust. They know that they are, you know, they're geologists like me, or they're mining engineers like me, or they're lighting electricians like me. And that's the professional bond, which I think in a way is even more important than the social.
Well, but don't they go hand in hand? Is it that separated?
Maybe it's not. Maybe professional is a shortcut to social.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah, because you're right, because it establishes a common framework initially, And that's what's needed to help build the social context, right? So if you're trying to transfer data or experience, knowledge, from X to Y, and those two have no previous shared reality, they don't have the same schooling, they don't have the same paradigms, that makes transfer kind of rough. It builds in some natural friction. But sometimes in this, as you're describing, if you've got parallels that make sense, that connect in some other way, then it makes everything else flow a little easier.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
And a common language as well, a common jargon. That's also important.
Well, this is my pet question. This is my pet peeve question. How many organizations don't have a glossary?
You mean actually a defined glossary? Because they've all got a glossary.
Yes. Oh, do they? As a folksonomy? Yeah. Is it formal?
It's probably not formal.
Don't you think that would help? Don't you just think that would help to have a formal glossary?
I think really helps in a couple of situations. One is when you've got the newbie coming in and they've got to build their technical language. They've got to learn all the acronyms.
Oh, yes.
And the other is when you merge two organizations and then you need to be very careful about the words you use. Or even going across sectors in the same organization. I remember talking with Steve Wynicke about, where was he working? General Motors, wasn't it? They were trying to define the parameters for different car parts. And one of the first things they had to do is actually get to a common vocabulary on what the car parts were, because the designers, you know, they might call them a door pillar and the manufacturers might call them a roof strut. They're talking about the same thing, but in different names.
Yeah, very confusing.
Well, you need to share knowledge. You need a shared language, obviously. Yeah. But that could stay internal to that particular group of people. Does it need to be fully defined? Yeah. I don't know.
Depends on the enterprise requirements, right? It depends on who's going to see the data or who's going to have contact. It gets back to that concept that I was floating around with, how the learner-centric model has shifted most of learning environments, in that there's more emphasis produced on how the person consumes best the data. Is it audio? Is it video? Is it text? Is it, you know, however that engagement is, becomes just as important as the subject matter expert standing up behind the podium lecturing.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is that organizations that have that ability to build better pathways, I guess it's just as simple as that. It's not just behaviors. It's not just software. It's not just hardware or procedures. It's a lot of things that allow flow to be less restricted.
Yep, that's right. There's another dimension to this, which is supply and demand.
Oh.
And this is another thing that I could talk for a long time about.
Sounds like economics to me.
Absolutely.
Oh, all right.
No, we're talking about knowledge economics.
Okay.
There's a lot of emphasis in many organizations about the supply of knowledge. You will create and share best practice. You will narrate your work. You will blog. You will push stuff out there. There's a lot less emphasis on actually creating the demand.
That just struck me as funny, because you're right.
Yeah. There was a really interesting article by McKinsey about, I think, 5 years ago, how they were looking at how help and advice flows around an organization. Mm. And they reckoned, I think it was about 80% of the examples where somebody helped somebody else, the trigger was a question. Yeah. The trigger was a request, just like going back to my story in Norway, just like the Australian saying, hey, can you help us? Have you got some good practice? I think if you've got oversupply, you depress the value. People who are being bombarded with knowledge treat it as trivial. If you've got undersupply, but a lively demand, you create value. People saying, hey, we need your help. Can you give this? Then people will say, yeah, I think that's really worth writing something down, coming to talk to you, sending somebody to Australia with a booklet. That's one thing that I found, I think, over my 23 years as a consultant, that we have to pay attention to the demand and then the supply will follow.
At least it gives you a governor or a buffer system in order to understand what you should be doing. If you don't understand how the consumer values anything, then it's a failed proposition. So you have to go to the user experience and understand this. I'm summing it up in different ways, but what you're saying is that if you don't rely on how consumers define value, maybe you have to restructure that training and awareness and building cultural awareness around what that should look like. And not all cultures know what they should do with knowledge. I think you're bringing up a concept I've not heard presented in that, because you're right. I think there's a heavy emphasis on just production. Produce. Well, in the world of volumes of data, that's not helpful.
Let me give you an example. When Yammer was first introduced, Yammer had, you opened up the page, there was a box to type in, and there was a prompt above the box. The prompt said, "What are you doing today?"
Oh, interesting.
So you would type in what you're doing. What if that prompt had said, "What do you need to know right now?" And you actually got people to put in questions? I think that would have been far more powerful.
That becomes a very liquid interface for a frequently asked question setup in that framework to where, but in order for that to work, you got to have participation on the other side instead of just people watching the ticker tape go by and not engaging the knowledge flow.
Let me give you another example. You're in a city. You see a car driving by. The driver of the car is obviously completely lost, doesn't know where they're going. People on the sidewalk know the city. What stops the knowledge flowing from the sidewalk to the car? Is it A, they won't tell him, or B, he won't ask? And it's usually a he. Yeah. It's he won't ask. If he asks, they'll be delighted to answer. Mm-hmm. But there's this wall.
There is a wall.
So I suppose you could say that the city is already pushing all of that information, because there's signposts saying this way to the Opera House and this way to the Washington Monument.
Yep.
But you always need something which hasn't got the sign. And there, that's where the questions come from.
Do you see a cultural approach to what you just described as the wall? Do you see any difference based on culture or region and or nationality? Is there a culture out there that just does that pretty damn well and it's not a big deal versus, I'm going to guess, the United States, where we don't ask directions? So, I'm just curious.
I mean, I've done quite a lot of investigation on culture, especially national culture and KM, but not along that dimension. I would probably point to the Netherlands as being a very, very open country, very, very open, and open to challenge, but also open to asking. You want a flat hierarchy, really. You don't want too much power distance. People have to be happy to say, "I don't know." And I think that's the culture that you want to put into the organization. And going back to BP, going back to Lord Brown, the chief executive of BP, he was such an insightful man. He said that every time we do something as an organization, my expectation is we'll do it better than the last time, which means that you have to go and ask how it was done last time and what the
success. How did it go? Exactly.
Learn? And he was pressing the button that made people ask. And he would also press the button by cutting the budget every time, of course. he would say, that was done for $500 million last time. I'm going to give you $450 million.
Yeah. Because make it work.
Every time we do it, we should do it better, cheaper, faster.
Oh, my good gravy. That's awesome. That is just powerful stuff right there. Mm-hmm. Most organizations grow fat because nobody challenges that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Absolutely.
Good gosh. It's like having a personal trainer for your business operations.
Yeah. Other CEOs have said that. Elon Musk said to the people, he sent an email to everybody in Tesla saying, if you don't know, you have a responsibility to ask. You should ask anyone to get an answer to your problem. It's not if you want to, you are responsible for asking. That's a real about change in culture.
We've talked around a lot of things in a very global way, but I want to get to these surveys. Can we kind of work into the global surveys and what that all means and what you've seen?
Yeah. Okay. Let me give you a bit of background to the surveys. In the mid-2010s, I was getting more and more broadly educated, if you like, as a consultant, by working in more and more different places, being involved with different cultures, different industries, different settings. And I thought, what is this knowledge management thing? Lots of people stand up and share what they think it is based on their experiences. But what if we asked the world, what is knowledge management and how does it work? I wonder what they'd say. So I put a survey together. It's a big survey. It's about 80 questions. It covers everything from the KM team, the technologies you use, the processes, the roles you have, the money you spend, how your communities work, how your lessons learning work. It's exhaustive. It's a good two cups of coffee, that survey. And it was really interesting. I got about 400 replies from knowledge managers around the world in 2014. That was the first one. So I thought I'd run it again 3 years later, see if there were any changes. That was 2017. And I ran it again in 2020. And I think I'll do it again this year. It takes a lot of time on my part because I've got lots of LinkedIn connections. I've got about 5,000 LinkedIn connections, most of whom are knowledge managers. And I send them all a message in LinkedIn. Then I follow it up again with a personalized message, follow it up again with a reminder a bit later. In fact, last time I sent the survey out, I was banned from LinkedIn three times because they thought I was a bot. I was sending so many messages. But we've now got over 1,000 replies to those three surveys. And I'll give you some of the headlines, if you like.
Please.
There's such a variety of organizations around the world. You could have, you know, you could have something like the US military with a million members. You could have 10 people working out of a garage somewhere in Vermont. You could have public sector, private sector, health sector, military sector. They've all got their own little angles on KM. So part of the interesting thing is balancing all that. The first thing I will say, over those 6 years, from 2014 to 17 to 20, there has been no major changes in KM. Nothing significant. The important things have remained important. The things that are less important have remained less important. Even AI seems to be a niche player. Maybe we do it again 2023. Maybe it's less of a niche. Who knows? Everybody wants to know what's new. And the answer to that, according to 1,000 people around the world, is not much. Of course, the technology changes. MS Teams now is probably top of the list for what people use for KM. Knowledge management is at its most embedded and has been most successful in large organizations headquartered in the USA, Canada, Western Europe. That's where the bulk of success has come from. India also potentially, but I've not recently got much back from India. Those big organizations, they've been doing it for decades. They focus on seven different things. And these seven different things are almost equal slices of the pie. Connecting people through communities and or networks, improved access to documents, creation and provision of best practices, learning from experience, knowledge retention, and innovation. That's six things, not seven. Those six things, they're beginning to shift a little bit. I mean, communities of practice used to be the number one focus area for most people. That's dropped to number four recently.
Do you think that the term has kind of changed? I mean, a community of practice 10 years ago was different than what we think of now with all the social platforms that may be an informal community of practice.
I don't know. I mean, I did ask about communities of practice or networks. So I was hoping that it wasn't just the term community of practice. I don't know why there has been less attention. Now, it could just be that data set I'm tapping into is shifting slightly. Maybe the big engineering firms, the big oil companies, maybe there were more of those in 2014 than there are now answering the survey. I don't think that's the case. I think there is a little shift away from communities. And I wonder if it is partly a technology thing that 10 years ago, there were lots of community-dedicated platforms with threaded discussion, topic-led. You could search, you could interrogate. They would build up a history of conversation. You don't see that sort of technology around nowadays. People are on the Microsoft suite, they're using Yammer. Yammer is a much more instant thing. The knowledge is here and then gone. You try and find something that was discussed last week in a Yammer thread, you'll never find it. So I think that old style community just doesn't have the technology base anymore. SharePoint used to have a community, community in a box, and they've dropped that. Also, the people I've been speaking to more recently about their communities, they seem to be smaller. Possibly that is also a technology thing. Microsoft Teams works great for a team of, 20, 30 people, but for a community of 1,000, it's clumsy. It's not happy.
So out of the total survey, how much would you percent-wise put nonprofit to for-profit as your respondents?
I don't know off the top of my head. I mean, it's probably about 20% not profit, I would think. Depends what you call not profit. I mean, you're presumably,
That's
yeah.
encouraging.
I mean, you've got the public sector, you've got the governmental, you've got the military, you've got the NGOs. Actually, the biggest set of respondents I got on the latest surveys were public sector.
Oh my.
I think there is an interest there, particularly in South Africa, particularly in areas in Southeast Asia, where the government is beginning to say to all its governmental bodies, you need to be managing knowledge. Yeah, same with the Middle East. You're seeing that quite a lot.
What do you see as the biggest gap? I know it's business sector's one piece, but between nonprofit or not for profit and for profit, is there similar pain points that are just equal? Or does one reflect something differently?
No, they do reflect differently. They take different focuses. If you were to look at the legal sector, for example, the legal sector is very focused on the management of documents. If you were to look at the other end of the scale, an organization that works in projects, then they're not particularly interested in documents. They're interested in experience and practice. And there you've got oil and gas, you've got military, you've got construction, you've got engineering. They would be very interested in communities of practice and lesson learning. The legal people would not be interested in them at all. They would be interested in search and retrieve, curation of documents. There you see a difference. The other difference is in size, of course. Knowledge management for a 10 people organization is very different from knowledge management for a 1,000 people, or 10,000, or even 100,000.
So who's doing it best?
I define best. Best in their own context. Has to be best in their own context. I can't answer that question. And I didn't even ask that question. I did ask people though to say how much value they delivered, to guesstimate how much value they delivered, and also if they couldn't attempt value to give a sort of a marks out of five. Now, the marks out of five, I don't really trust very much because lots of people don't know what good looks like.
Exactly.
This is a big challenge in KM. Lots of people don't know what good KM looks like, so they don't know whether there are a five or a three. However, there are so few people actually putting a value figure on it that I couldn't really say what drives the most value, apart from size and the number of years you've been doing it. As you might expect, the bigger organizations deliver the most value, and the longer they've been at it, the better they get at it, and the more they deliver overall and per year.
Does the ISO, the International Standard for Knowledge Management, drive any value for any of these respondents? Was that something that you looked at?
That is something I looked at. I asked that question in the last survey, the 2020 survey. 80% of the respondents have heard of it. Just over half planned to use it. But only 4% had actually conducted any sort of internal or external audit
Interesting.
against it. So it's too early to say, I think.
Do you think the ISO could be converted to be a metric to evaluate instead of making a subjective evaluation of how you think you're doing?
That is its purpose. It's the ISO standard has got 57 occurrences of the word shall. You shall do this, or you shall do that. You shall create a knowledge management policy, and your policy shall contain the following items. And if you meet all 57 shalls, then you are compliant with the standard. So you could say, how many of those shalls can you actually hand on heart agree with? And that would give you a 57-point scale from 0 to 57. But I think part of the problem is that if it becomes a self-assessment, it's like one of these questionnaires you fill in Men's Monthly about how fit are you? Yeah, and we're all incredibly fit. Okay. Of course we are. When we tick all the boxes, but you get a personal trainer come to your house and they shake their head. So self-assessment is a difficult thing to do.
Okay.
Before we leave the survey, I think there are a couple of things that I do want to pull out on. I mean, there is a lot of value delivered from KM. And there, when you look at it as world as a whole, you can see where that value comes from. And you can see, I think the average, let me see, average mean value from all three surveys was 65 million delivered from knowledge management. That's down a bit from 2014, but up a bit from 2017. But one thing that I did notice, if you look at the budget that people have, the annual budget, that has dropped year on year. The annual budget on the last survey, the average annual budget was about a third of a million. Now, of course, you know, you've got organizations at both ends of the scale. So I'm just taking an average. It was two thirds of a million 3 years before. 6 years before, it was nearly a million. The budget is dropping, if you believe those three figures. There are a lot of caveats there. I'm not surprised. It does seem to be a harder sell nowadays.
Let's define knowledge management. How does Nick Milton put a label on defining KM?
I go with the definition in ISO 30401, partly because I was on the team that wrote that definition, and I fought hard for the definition. I liked my original definition. It's been softened since, but my definition of knowledge management is management with a focus on knowledge. So I turn it around. It's not management of knowledge. It is how you manage when you understand the value of knowledge. Mm. And there's your challenge and there's your opportunity, because if you are looking for a KM budget, your leadership don't know how much knowledge is worth. If they did know how much knowledge is worth, they would be showering money at you. So your challenge and your opportunity is to show them the potential value of knowledge.
So sometimes that's a hard sell. And you've said that, and I've seen it, where you're trying to show value, but is it just as easy to show the risk? If we want to talk economic terms, then your risk advertisement is probably more valuable than what I can show you what you may get out of this. I had one guest say this, see what you think about this. And I think it was, I'll have to double check, but I think it was Andrew Trickett from Arup.
Oh, yeah.
I think he said on this show that if your competitive advantage can gain 1% by what KM can bring, how can you afford not to do it?
That's the risk of not doing it versus the advantage of doing it. That's risk, and you're presenting the cost of not doing it. There is a cost of lost knowledge. You can have a go at estimating what that might be by looking at lessons not learned, mistakes repeated, clients being lost for the same reason, inefficiencies that are not being fixed. You can do a little bit of digging through the past projects. Mm. We did that in BP, going back to 1996, I think. We estimated that $500 million a year was being lost through a lack of knowledge management.
I bet you that got somebody's attention.
That did, yeah. And of course, what they said to us, what the steering team said to us is, right, we'll give you a year, you demonstrate $100 million in return. We thought that was a tough ask, but in fact, it was relatively straightforward.
Oh.
Low-hanging fruit in knowledge management hangs very low and is big and fat and juicy.
Okay. How did you calculate all these savings for them to in that first year? That just sounds like a heck of a thing to try to do.
Well, the savings had to be reflected in the following year's budget request.
Oh.
So that wasn't just our claim, that was the business. Mm. BP was just building a whole suite of gas stations around Europe, and they held a peer assist about how can we do this. And somebody came to the peer assist with a bright idea of you do it as a strategic partnership with a construction company. Don't do it yourself. Work with one of the big constructors. And lo and behold, that was worth, I don't know, 50 million in itself, just that little bit of knowledge, you know. And then there was, if you do repeat lesson learning on a series of projects, knowledge management delivers the most value where the most money is spent. Building big oil platforms, drilling deep water wells, these are all areas where you can go in and save a month here, a day there, and it adds up very quickly into millions. That's partly why.
So how does a small organization make it work? We've talked about very large enterprises, multinationals, global entities. But how does a small nonprofit or a small business that's got 20 folks or less capitalize on trying to do knowledge management and make it part of their culture?
I think, again, you ask the same question. What is the cost of not doing it? Say you're a small organization, you're a startup. Your dream is to be a big organization. At some point, you've got to start cloning yourselves and setting up offices around the world. How are you going to do that unless you can give those clones knowledge? So right from the start, think about capturing your knowledge so that you can then use that to replicate yourself in a different part of the world. If you don't do it, your new market entry is going to take a lot longer. It's going to be a lot riskier. You may not even make a profit in those new markets. If you do pay attention to knowledge, you can be very smart and very strategic and build up like crazy.
You brought up a point that I think small organizations, nonprofit or for-profit, they're so busy wrapped into the tactical approach of what needs to be done that it's hard or difficult, I will say, to break that day-to-day kind of forward motion to start in the strategic mindset in order to understand what the, you know, even in the baseline, if we didn't even think about we're going to scale and duplicate, what if you just had a contingency for when you kick the bucket, somebody can pick up the pieces? You know, even if you just went baseline and just try to sell them on a contingency effort for sustainment of the organization, that would be enough, you would think, to get people interested. But I got to tell you, it's still a hard sell.
Yeah, I think that's a harder sell because it's a what if, you know, what if you were hit by a bus?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to think about that. But if you say, look, here is a prize you can gain from an asset you've already got, you don't have to spend very much at all, maybe one person or half a person. I was working in BP Norway. One third of my job was knowledge management. And that was an office of 100 people.
Wow.
If you've got a 100-person startup, yeah, give them a knowledge manager. Make somebody accountable for making sure that knowledge is captured.
Wait a minute. You just used the A word. What organization makes anybody accountable? Come on. Where does that come from?
Accountable.
For knowledge.
Of course they do. You see that in the military all the time.
I'm just saying in the civilian population, what organization carries that flag forward to say, hey, you're accountable and responsible for your knowledge sharing? But you know, the reason I bring that up is, can't we just have HR put that into all the job descriptions and make sure everybody, instead of having an AKM person own it?
Everybody's responsible, not everybody is accountable.
Ooh.
Okay. Right? It's like safety.
Mm.
Everybody is responsible for safe activities, but you still have an accountable safety officer. And you have an accountable safety department for making sure that that happens. Same with KM. And that is part of ISO 30401. The whole concept of delegated accountability is in there very clearly. Section 5, I think it is. Yeah, Section 5, the leadership section. Mm-hmm. Not only has leadership got to espouse knowledge management, they also have to delegate it clearly downwards.
That seems to be a weak link in some organizations. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. They put out the policy, they put out the direction, the doctrine, the format, the organizational structure, and then they're just like, okay. We did that. We're good.
But what happens is it gets, everyone ignores it.
What? No way. The culture is the rub, right? So it all comes down to the culture, if they're going to play or not going to play. If you want to make people accountable, and you want to get engagement to where knowledge is a good asset for an organization that's positively moving forward, can an organization just start cutting the dead weight of, you know, around this? What I'm getting to is that there seems to be not a heavy enough hand to make this accountability piece and the participation piece in the knowledge ecosystem a formal requirement. A formal, like you could say, you know, you have not done this. You need to move on. You need to find a new job or, you know, that sort of thing.
I know. No organization would do that from day one. The early years of knowledge management are all about proving concept, testing the tools, building a framework that works in your organization, in your context. And then there comes a time when you have proven the value and you want to make it stick. And that's where the hand gets heavier. That's where you see things like the NASA knowledge policy. If you look at that online, right at the top of the page in red letters, it says compliance is mandatory.
Well, that's pretty specific. That's
very specific. That's where you start to ask your CEO to send out the messages that Bob Buckman used to give. He used to say, if you are not interested in contributing to knowledge management, the many opportunities open to you in the past will no longer be available. That's late stage behavior. But if you look at how you embed a safety culture or a quality culture or even a financial management culture, mm-hmm. if you find somebody in your organization who is not following the financial rules, they got a rap on the knuckles. If you find somebody in your organization who is willfully ignoring the safety system, they get shown the door. One day, knowledge management will reach that level if it's important enough.
That's the challenge. That is the challenge for anyone listening out there. If you're not going to back it up with a little bit of a stick, you're never going to get there. And those comparables should make the baseline pretty understandable. Mm. Especially on the safety thing. If you see somebody that is doing everything against normal standards when it comes to safety, that is a huge liability and you can't afford to keep it. Why not have the equal amount of weight towards knowledge handling?
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Why not? I'm with you.
There's one reason why, and that's because a safety incident is far more visible than a lost knowledge incident. Mm. You can see somebody limping off with a broken leg. It's harder to see those opportunities where somebody learned a lesson and never shared it and somebody else had a failed project as a result.
Granted, it may be harder to prove, it may be harder to have evidence, but maybe we need to change how we're thinking of what the evidence is. Or maybe there's a way that in a data sense, in a metadata sense, that knowledge that is used, transferred, transformed by another handler, and I'm just thinking of, you know, the other person in the chain of custody, if you will, of cause and effect in that relationship, if there's a way we could track and automate what touched me, what got shared, what I then produced from this knowledge or data and transformed into X, I think there's a challenge there that could be helped greatly to help facilitate a clearer understanding of that accountability and what it got you.
Yeah. There are elements of knowledge management where that's quite easily done. The whole lesson learning piece, for example. You can set up a lesson management software where lessons are entered. They're tracked to people for information. They're tracked to other people for action. You can see whether the actions have been cleared out. You can see how long the whole thing takes. And you can tighten it up and you can speed it up. And people within that system will have the accountability that if a lesson comes to them with an action attached, they need to respond. You can do that in certain settings. And again, you'll be well familiar with that sort of setting in the military.
Yeah.
You don't complete your patrol without doing the after action review and the after action report at the end of the engagement. And the lessons from that go out and they're acted upon. And you know your role in it, and you trust that the system works. Again, we can do that in industry as well. And there are certain places in the oil sector, in NASA, in other sectors where that is done. And those do tend to be the areas where the industries where knowledge management failures are most visible and most expensive.
We've just wrapped up the first segment with Nick Milton. Make sure to stay tuned for the second segment where we dig into the international standard for knowledge management. Or organization would like to help us continue this mission and sponsor one of our shows, email BYNTK at pioneer-ks.org. You have just finished our latest Because You Need to Know, a public service of Pioneer Knowledge Services. Please join us on LinkedIn and find us at pioneer-ks.org.